conversation ended, Shumkov pulled his exec Frolov by the arm out of earshot from the others and whispered, "I have no intention of arming or shooting that weapon. We'd go up with it if we did." That conversation was for his ears, and he nodded over at the Zampolit, the Communist Party political officer, who was looking at the depth gauge. "Regardless of what happens, I know he'll report what I was or wasn't prepared to do." Frolov stared at the captain for a moment, then slowly nodded in full understanding. The skipper was covering his ass by appearing ready to fire the special torpedo, but in fact he had no intention of firing anything. The Zampolit would report it all if they survived. What seems significant about this story is that it implies Shumkov believed it would look better for him, in the political officer's report to his superiors, if he had appeared ready to use the special weapon against his pursuers, despite the absence of any authorization from Moscow. Such a judgment would have been sound, considering the reception the four captains got when they returned to port, which was even colder than they expected, three of them having been discovered by American anti-submarine forces, and having chosen eventually to surface under the guns of those forces, rather than to suffocate or go down, or to use their weapons, starting with the special one. The day after they returned to port, they were debriefed at a commission that was aimed exclusively at uncovering violations of orders, documents, or instructions by the commander or by the personnel. The commanders were especially criticized for violating the conditions of secrecy by surfacing, or as some other superiors at the commission told them, rather than surface, they should have violated their written orders under the circumstances. Despite the lack of authorization from Moscow, they should have used their weapons, starting with this special weapon. It was not until 40 years later that American scholars and former officials first heard of this latter choice as even a possibility. It was to them an unimagined response to the conditions that McNamara's directive and the Navy's practices had been imposing on Soviet submarines, which were, unknown to U.S. intelligence and decision-makers, armed with nuclear warheads. Conditions on the submarines, meanwhile, were hardly conducive to sound judgment. These were Foxtrot-type subs, which were meant for the Northern Circle. They had never been in warm water before, and their ventilators had broken down. It was 140 degrees Fahrenheit in the main compartments. The coolest part of the sub was 113 degrees, next to the torpedoes, and the crew would take turns going there for a few minutes to recover. Carbon dioxide was building up, because they hadn't been able to go up and snorkel and get more oxygen and some cool air. Crew members were dropping. At the Havana conference on the 40th anniversary of the crisis in 2002, before an audience that included Robert McNamara, McGeorge Bundy, and naval officers from the Soviet Alpha Group of hunter-killer submarines, Vadim Orlov, chief of the Special Signals Intelligence Detachment on the B-59, described conditions underwater that Saturday afternoon from the point of view of men in a barrel or rabbits in a cage. "For some time we were able to avoid them quite successfully. However, the Americans were not dilettantes either. Starting at 4:59 p.m. on Saturday, October 27th, they surrounded us and started to tighten the circle, practicing attacks and dropping depth charges. They exploded right next to the hull. It felt like you were sitting in a metal barrel, which somebody is constantly blasting with a sledgehammer. The temperature in the compartments was 45 to 50 Celsius, up to 60 Celsius, 113 to 122 degrees Fahrenheit, up to 140, in the engine compartment. The level of CO2 in the air reached a critical mark, practically deadly for people. One of the duty officers fainted and fell down. Then another one followed, then a third one. They were falling like dominoes. But we were still holding on, trying to escape. We were suffering like this for about 4 hours. The Americans hit us with something stronger than the grenades, depth charges, apparently with a practical depth bomb. We thought, that's it, the end. After this attack, the totally exhausted Savitsky, who, in addition to everything, was not able to establish connection with the general staff, became furious. He summoned the officer who was assigned to the nuclear torpedo and ordered him to assemble it to battle readiness. "Maybe the war has already started up there, while we are doing somersaults here," screamed emotional Valentin Grigorievich, trying to justify his order. "We're going to blast them now. We will die, but we will sink them all. We will not disgrace our navy." Orloff's account continues. "But we did not fire the nuclear torpedo. Savitsky was able to rein in his wrath. After consulting with Second Captain Vasily Alexandrovich Arkhipov and his deputy political officer, Ivan Semenovich Meslinikov, he made the decision to come to the surface." But there was more to that story. At least two officers were required to agree on the firing of this special weapon. The captain and the political officer, in this case Meslinikov. According to Orloff, Meslinikov agreed with Savitsky's order to fire. On another sub, that would have been sufficient. These two each had half a key that was required to fire the special weapon. The special weapons officer next to the torpedo also had a key. But on this submarine, a third concurrence was required, because the chief of staff of the brigade, Vasily Arkhipov, was traveling with him. In terms of command on the vessel, Arkhipov, who was of the same rank as Savitsky, was second to the commander, Savitsky. Nevertheless, for this decision, because of his role in the brigade, Arkhipov's agreement was also required, and he withheld it. He did so on the grounds, which Savitsky and Meslinikov understood as well as he, but which they chose to ignore under the circumstances, that Moscow had not authorized it. Had Arkhipov been stationed on one of the other submarines, for example B-4, which was never located by the Americans, there is every reason to believe that the carrier USS Randolph and several, perhaps all of its accompanying destroyers, would within minutes of the agreement by Savitsky and Meslinikov, have been destroyed by a nuclear explosion, or if not destroyed, then drenched in a lethal bath of radioactive water that would incapacitate crew members almost immediately and kill them soon after. The source of this explosion would have been mysterious to other commanders in the Navy and officials on the XCOM, since no submarines known to be in the region were believed to carry nuclear warheads. The clear implication on the cause of the nuclear destruction of this anti-submarine hunter-killer group would have been a medium-range missile from Cuba whose launch had not been detected. That is the event that President Kennedy had announced on October 22nd would lead to a full-scale nuclear attack on the Soviet Union. Savitsky and Arkhipov are now both dead and cannot testify further. But Arkhipov's widow, Olga Arkhipova, says he told her they came close to firing the nuclear torpedo. Had that happened, we would probably not be reading this. The fear of Robert McNamara on October 27, 1962, that he might not see another sunset, would have been realized. Olga Arkhipova in 2012 was justly proud that her husband, Vasily Alexandrovich, had, since the Havana Conference 10 years earlier, become known as the man who saved the world. But there was even more going on that Saturday. During the morning, while McNamara was in the tank with the Joint Chiefs, word came through that an American SAC U-2 under General Power had wandered into Soviet airspace. The story was that it was a weather plane that went off course. Most of us, and I suspect the President, assumed that Power was playing a game, and that he, like his boss LeMay, wanted to go to war. When he received this news, according to a 1975 oral history interview with Air Force General David Birchenall, McNamara rushed out of the Pentagon meeting yelling hysterically, "This means war with the Soviet Union!" In the height of the crisis, the Russians might have assumed that this was a reconnaissance plane preparing for an all-out attack. In a message to Kennedy on October 28, agreeing to dismantle his missile sites on Cuba, Khrushchev expressed concern that the American intruder could have easily been mistaken for a nuclear bomber, which might push us to a fateful step. The U-2's pilot had been confused by the northern lights over the pole and gone in the wrong direction. By the time he realized his mistake, he was over the Chukot Peninsula in the Soviet Union. Running out of fuel, the pilot turned around and proceeded to glide for miles, unaware that MiGs were coming after him, attempting to intercept him and shoot him down. Meanwhile, Alaskan Air Command scrambled F-102A fighters to protect the U-2. These fighters, designed to confront not MiGs but Russian bombers coming over the pole, were armed only with nuclear air-to-air missiles, Fortunately, they did not encounter the MiGs, and the U-2 coasted safely home. Roger Hilsman, chief of the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the State Department, happened to be in the White House when word of this incident arrived. In a panic, he rushed in to tell the president there was a U-2 over Russia being pursued by MiGs. Kennedy, very cool, responded from his rocking chair, as Hilsman reported, with an old Navy joke. There's always some son of a bitch who didn't get the word. If, on Saturday, Khrushchev had reason to believe he was losing control over his own forces in Cuba, he had similar grounds to doubt his counterpart's control over events. In their meeting that night, Robert Kennedy told Dobrynin, among other things, "Those favoring diplomacy are losing momentum. It's going to be hard to stop this process. The generals are itching for a fight. They want to go." The message that Khrushchev took from Dobrynin's account was that if this crisis continued to escalate, Kennedy might well face a coup. Yes, the world of humans came very close to ending in October 1962, closer than anyone in high office in the United States imagined at the time, or for some 40 years afterward. Certainly far closer than I could have conceived. This was not because the two opposing leaders were rash or reckless or insensitive to the potential dangers. Both, in fact, were cautious to a degree that neither could know, more cautious than the world or most of their associates could realize. Furthermore, they both shared an extreme abhorrence for the idea of nuclear war, which they recognized as potentially the end of civilization and even humanity. On that terrible Saturday night, October 27th, when the fate of the world hung in the balance, Robert Kennedy described his brother's thoughts that evening in the Oval Office. The thought that disturbed him most, and that made the prospect of war much more fearful than it would otherwise have been, was the specter of the death of the children of this country and all the world, the young people who had no role, who had no say, who knew nothing even of the confrontation, but whose lives would be snuffed out like everyone else's. They would never have a chance to make a decision, to vote in an election, to run for office, to lead a revolution, to determine their own destinies. Khrushchev saw the stakes in identical terms. In his personal letter to the president on October 26th, he wrote, "Mr. President, we and you ought not now to pull on the ends of the rope in which you have tied the knot of war, because the more the two of us pull, the tighter that knot will be tied. And a moment may come when that knot will be tied so tight that even he who tied it will not have the strength to untie it, and then it will be necessary to cut that knot. And what that would mean is not for me to explain to you, because you yourself understand perfectly of what terrible forces our countries dispose. Consequently, if there is no intention to tighten that knot, and thereby to doom the world to the catastrophe of thermonuclear war, then let us not only relax the forces pulling on the ends of the rope, let us take measures to untie that knot. We are ready for this." Neither saw the stakes in Cuba as high enough to justify even a moderately low risk of nuclear war, and both were determined to find a peaceful resolution of the crisis. In fact, as I said earlier, I believe that each leader was, contrary to his public declarations, and in Kennedy's case secretly from almost all his advisers, determined to the extent that he had control over events, not to go to war, not to permit armed conflict to arise between American and Soviet forces under any circumstances. I believe that each of them, from an early stage in the public confrontation, and earlier for Kennedy, was determined to end the crisis on the other's terms if necessary, rather than let events escalate to actual combat. And yet the world came close to nuclear war. Each was directing his military to carry out provocative activities. On the Soviet side, making the missiles operational on a crash basis in Cuba, and sending submarine patrols in the Caribbean. On the American side, pursuing all preparations for an invasion of Cuba, and pressing aggressive low-level aerial reconnaissance over Cuba while harassing Soviet submarines. Each of them was prolonging the crisis day by day while they haggled over the resolution of the conflict, each hoping to achieve better terms than he was prepared at bottom to accept. If Khrushchev had not, surprisingly, initiated an abrupt, humiliating withdrawal of his missiles Sunday morning, without even waiting for an official American response to his proposal of Saturday morning, which Kennedy had argued to his advisers was very reasonable, there was every likelihood of the fuse to all-out war being lit by that afternoon. How close did that come? As close as the unpredictable decision of one man to overrule two others on a Soviet submarine, or the inaccuracy of Cuban anti-aircraft gunners, improving every hour, on their first day of firing at live targets. Far greater than 1 in 100. Greater that day than Nitz's 1 in 10. And that was for reasons which I didn't know, and no other Americans knew, for 30 and in some cases 40 years. The world has yet to absorb the lessons of this history. The story of how the existence of humanity was placed in great, unjustifiable danger by men who had no intention of doing that, men who recoiled from ending human history, or from taking what they saw as a high or even significant risk of doing so. A primary lesson I draw from this episode is that the existential danger to humanity of nuclear weapons does not rest solely or even mainly on the possibility of further proliferation of such weapons to rogue or unstable nations, who would handle and threaten them less responsibly than the permanent members of the Security Council. Nor does it rest merely on the vagaries of the smaller and more recent nuclear weapon states of Israel, India, Pakistan, and North Korea, though these do enhance the dangers. What a true history of the Cuban Missile Crisis reveals is that the existence of masses of nuclear weapons in the hands of leaders of the superpowers, the United States and Russia, even when those leaders are about as responsible, humane, and cautious as any we have seen, posed then, and still do, intolerable dangers to the survival of civilization. Just such leaders in both countries, each presiding over nuclear forces much smaller than at present, despite the reductions of the last two decades, came horrifyingly close to possibly launching those forces, something that neither remotely contemplated at the start of the crisis. For several crucial days, I believe, Kennedy and Khrushchev were each privately prepared to back down. But not yet, as they sparred with forces armed with thermonuclear weapons. If their bargaining had gone on one more day, then nearly all then-living humans might have died from it, and few, if any, now alive would ever have existed. Yet, have we had a president since World War II who would have acted in those circumstances more responsibly, more prudently? Do we have such a president now? Does Russia? Let me give one last quote from the one who finally did back down, just in time, with the advantage of knowing what the other did not. Khrushchev told Norman Cousins a few months after the crisis his reaction at the time. When I asked the military advisers if they could assure me that holding fast would not result in the death of 500 million human beings, they looked at me as though I was out of my mind, or what was worse, a traitor. The biggest tragedy, as they saw it, was not that our country might be devastated and everything lost, but that the Chinese or the Albanians might accuse us of appeasement or weakness. So I said to myself, to hell with these maniacs. If I can get the United States to assure me that it will not attempt to overthrow the Cuban government, I will remove the missiles. That is what happened, and now I am reviled by the Chinese and the Albanians. They say I was afraid to stand up to a paper tiger. It is all such nonsense. What good would it have done me in the last hour of my life to know that though our great nation and the United States were in complete ruins, the national honor of the Soviet Union was intact? That last line, indeed the whole quote, deserves to be studied by all those whose fingers hover over the trigger to a doomsday machine. Part 2. The Road to Doomsday. Chapter 14. Bombing Cities. Where did the road to doomsday begin? The fission bomb mechanism that made it possible was first envisioned by theoretical physicists. It was then tested in the desert at Alamogordo, New Mexico. Its potential was finally revealed to the world in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But before that, when and how did it become possible to imagine that setting fire to cities and burning civilians from the sky was not only an acceptable, but also a necessary way to wage war? What change in consciousness transformed what had previously been regarded as an unspeakable war crime into the official policy of the world's leading democracies? That change preceded the formal dawn of the nuclear era, but it relied on two crucial developments, which happened to converge in World War II. First, the belief by some militarists that air power was the key to victory. And second, the increasing willingness by civilian leadership and air commanders to regard cities, which is to say civilian populations, as legitimate military targets. Each of those developments has its own particular history. The beginning of World War II in Europe provides an available benchmark as to what the conscience of humanity up to that time deemed natural and reasonable when it came to waging war. On September 1, 1939, the day Hitler invaded Poland, marking the official outbreak of World War II, President Franklin D. Roosevelt addressed this appeal to all the belligerent states. The ruthless bombing from the air of civilians in unfortified centers of population during the course of the hostilities, which have raged in various quarters of the earth during the past few years, which have resulted in the maiming and death of thousands of defenseless men, women, and children, has sickened the hearts of civilized men and women, and has profoundly shocked the conscience of humanity. If resort is had to this form of human barbarism during the period of the tragic conflagration with which the world is now confronted, hundreds of thousands of innocent human beings who have no responsibility for, and who are not even remotely participating in the hostilities which have now broken out, will lose their lives. I am therefore directing this urgent appeal to every government which may be engaged in hostilities, publicly to affirm its determination that its armed forces shall in no event, and under no circumstances, undertake the bombardment from the air of civilian populations or of unfortified cities, upon the understanding that these same rules of warfare will be scrupulously observed by all their opponents. I request an immediate reply. The very next day, Britain, before it formally declared war on Germany, gave that affirmation, declaring that the British and French would conduct hostilities with a firm desire to spare the civilian population, and had already sent explicit instructions to the commanders of their armed forces, prohibiting the bombardment of any except strictly military objectives in the narrowest sense of the word. This was shortly followed by a similar agreement from Germany. In fact, none of these governments, at least at the highest levels, had any plan or intention at this time to pursue the deliberate bombing of cities. That included the government of Adolf Hitler. Roosevelt's message was not an appeal to a new standard of conduct in war. Quite the contrary. He was reaffirming the importance of what was regarded as an international norm, part of the common law of international relations, despite recent violations of it by fascist powers that had been widely and strongly condemned. The British instructions, referenced in their reply to FDR, included the following three principles, enunciated in Parliament by the Prime Minister in June 1938. 1. It is against international law to bomb civilians as such, and to make deliberate attacks on the civilian population. 2. Targets which are aimed at from the air must be legitimate military objectives, and must be capable of identification. And 3. Reasonable care must be taken in attacking those military objectives, so that by carelessness a civilian population in the neighborhood is not bombed. Britain introduced these three principles in a League of Nations Assembly resolution, which was unanimously adopted on September 30, 1938. Nevertheless, a significant minority of the air services of Britain, Bomber Command, and the U.S. Army Air Forces, USAAF, had for a generation been preparing and hoping for a much broader bombing strategy, targeting industry and population, violating these international restrictions. They found FDR's multilateral agreement constraining and regrettable. But no one, neither the British nor Hitler, wanted to be seen initiating the process of city bombing that FDR's appeal had denounced. FDR's reference to the ruthless bombing during the past few years pointed to the Japanese bombing of Chinese cities, beginning with an attack on Shanghai in 1937, and the bombing of Spanish cities, Barcelona, Granollers, and Guernica, by Italian and German fascist forces in 1937 and 1938. Actually, 5 years earlier, in January 1932, Japanese carrier aircraft had bombed the Chinese section of the International Settlement in Shanghai, causing 1,000 deaths in what Barbara Tuchman described as the first terror bombing of a civilian population of an era that was to become familiar with it. The bombing of the city center of Guernica by German Condor Legion aircraft on April 26, 1937, the German role being clandestine and denied by the supposedly neutral Nazi government, became and has remained ever since iconic for civilian suffering from such attacks, especially after it inspired the Picasso painting. But nothing has ever expressed the general gut-felt moral revulsion against city bombing better than a virtually unknown article from first-hand experience by America's most famous writer at the time, Ernest Hemingway, in July 1938. It's still little known because he wrote it by request for the Soviet newspaper Pravda, which published it in Russian. His manuscript in English didn't surface for 44 years. It conveys in words the same surreal images that Picasso had rendered on canvas the year before. His lead sentence: "During the last 15 months I saw murder done in Spain by the fascist invaders. Murder is different from war." Hemingway was describing what he had seen of fascist bombing of workers' housing in Barcelona and shelling of civilian cinema-goers in Madrid. "You see the murdered children with their twisted legs, their arms that bend in wrong directions, and their plaster-powdered faces. You see the women, sometimes unmarked when they die from concussion, their faces gray, green matter running out of their mouths from bursted gallbladders. You see them sometimes looking like bloodied bundles of rags. You see them sometimes blown capriciously into fragments as an insane butcher might sever a carcass. And you hate the Italian and German murderers who do this, as you hate no other people. When they shell the cinema crowds, concentrating on the squares where people will be coming out at 6 o'clock, it is murder. You see a shell hit a queue of women standing in line to buy soap. There are only 4 women killed, but a part of one woman's torso is driven against a stone wall so that blood is driven into the stone with such force that sandblasting later fails to clean it. The other dead lie like scattered black bundles, and the wounded are moaning or screaming." Hemingway's moral and emotional reaction that what he was witnessing was criminal, murder, even in wartime, reflected the general values of that period that underlay the appeal by President Roosevelt a year later, and that were in fact proclaimed by the American and British governments, increasingly disingenuously, to their publics consistently throughout the war that followed. In any case, the agreement of September 1939 did not hold. Hitler's bombing of London in 1940, the Blitz, was an obvious breach. But a full year after the Blitz, largely for operational reasons, the civilian and military leaders of Britain officially and deliberately, though secretly from their public, adopted and expanded the tactics of Hitler's attack on London as their primary basis for attacks in Germany from early 1942 on. In time, likewise for operational reasons, not because of a newly discovered effectiveness of these tactics, nor because USAAF commanders had rejected their initial antipathy to such terror attacks, but because they found it difficult to do anything else in bad weather or at night, the United States also joined in, particularly in Japan, from early 1945, the targeting of cities with the aim of causing maximum civilian casualties, what FDR had termed a form of human barbarism, became really the only form of attack waged by the bomber forces under General Curtis LeMay. This policy was kept secret throughout the war from the citizens of Britain and the United States, because the public posture of Churchill, Roosevelt, and then Truman was that they were observing, as well as could be done under the circumstances, the very old principles of the immunity of non-combatants, civilians, from deliberate attack. That was a lie. Instead, midway in World War II, These two democratic liberal governments secretly adopted Hitler's tactics of terror bombing civilians and obliterated the distinction between combatants and non-combatants in their bombing operations. They were thereby rejecting the principles of just war doctrine, which they and their successors have continued to this day to publicly endorse. How this came to be and why is crucial to understanding nuclear war planning today. The principles of just war, codified by international jurists starting with Hugo Grotius in the 17th century, reflected a civilizing response to the more destructive religious wars of the past, particularly the Thirty Years' War in Germany. The restrictions on war, above all, against deliberate killing of non-combatants, were contrasted to the wars of the barbarians, Genghis Khan, Tamerlane, and others, who had regularly put cities to the sword, killing all males, killing or enslaving all women and children, sometimes even constructing pyramids of the skulls of their victims. The 17th through the 19th centuries saw the adoption of notions first articulated by Augustine for the Catholic Church, and later elaborated by Thomas Aquinas in the Middle Ages. The so-called just war doctrine established conditions under which war could be legitimately undertaken. Jus ad bellum. This called for a just cause, usually national defense or declaration by competent authority. But there were also conditions regarding the just means of waging war. Jus in bello. In other words, restrictions on the kinds of violence that even a Christian monarch could order or a Christian soldier could obey. These Catholic doctrines were taken up by most of the Reformation churches, and later by secularized international law. Even a legitimate authority acting in self-defense could not do simply anything in the way of violence to an enemy. Such forces were obliged to respect an absolute distinction between combatants and non-combatants, with non-combatants, essentially civilians, to be absolutely immune from deliberate attack. By and large, these principles continued to be observed up to the outset of World War II. In his 1939 appeal, Roosevelt was really doing nothing more than reminding the various belligerents of the clear-cut principles of civilized behavior in warfare at that time, norms of international law. Thus it was not surprising that the various belligerents, even Nazi Germany, would give formal acceptance to this appeal, though the Japanese in China and the Germans in Spain had already clearly violated its principles. But long before World War II, something had been happening in the nature of warfare to erode elite commitment to those norms. A century after Grotius, the French Revolution led for the first time to conscription on a mass basis. Earlier wars since the Middle Ages, except religious wars which were particularly barbaric, had been fought by small numbers of mercenaries, often foreigners, working for a prince, a warlord of some sort, or a small state. The French Revolution introduced a spirit of patriotism, a feeling of widespread enthusiasm and support for a cause, which made it possible to mobilize a whole nation in a way that had not been possible in the previous several hundred years. This coincided, more or less, with the dawn of industrialization, affording the possibility of arming these masses, transporting them, and supplying them with cannons, and later Gatling guns and machine guns. In particular, the use of railroads for the first time in our Civil War made possible an enormous increase in the range, extent, and destructiveness of war. These developments worked together to make the whole nation become a participant in a war between states. All this helped to plant the deadly seeds that later flowered in the doctrine of strategic bombing, the notion that nearly every citizen of the opponent's country was a legitimate target, since many of them could be said to be contributing in some way or another to military operations. That began most obviously with those in war industries, making munitions, but it also applied to those in basic industries that fed into the war machinery: steel, energy, coal, and oil, transportation and communications. This blurred the distinction between combatants and non-combatants, but the implications of this change were not immediately expressed. One of the first applications of this changed perception was Sherman's march through Georgia, destroying harvests, stores, and infrastructure along the way. Sherman is often remembered for his statement, "War is hell." And this was not just an observation. His theory of war was that it should be made as close to hell as possible for one's opponents, so they would end it quicker. And the innovation that he introduced, which was observed from Europe as an act of barbarism, and is so remembered in the South to this day, was to allow his troops to attack the city of Atlanta as a whole, destroying most of its stores and burning the city. He then moved from Atlanta to the sea, burning stores, fields, and logistics supplies as he went, partly to destroy the supplies of the armies opposing him, and partly, quite explicitly and openly, to punish and terrorize the population, to make them realize that they must pay a price for supporting this secession, or in allowing their leadership to continue the war. Despite this precursor to the era of total war, the large-scale military attack on the economy and social order of an opponent, this strategy was not really implemented in World War I, which by and large remained a traditional war of soldiers battling other soldiers. Most of the huge number of people who died directly from military operations in World War I were military. Between 9 million and 13 million soldiers died out of perhaps 65 million troops worldwide. In the minds of a lot of soldiers and their generals, there was a potential in this experience for erosion of the moral significance of the distinction between combatants and non-combatants as a basis for restraint in warfare. Military men in World War I could see the deaths of soldiers on the fields of France and Belgium and elsewhere as very like massacres, even though these people were wearing uniforms. On the first day of the Battle of the Somme, July 1, 1916, 20,000 British soldiers died. Another 40,000 were wounded or missing. Within a few months, there were over 1 million casualties on both sides in that campaign, which moved battle lines a few miles from time to time, one way or the other. The next year, in the Passchendaele campaign, General Sir Douglas Haig sent men into fields in Flanders in an area where shelling had destroyed the dikes. The arrival of the rainy season turned the fields into bogs of mud several feet deep. Every shell hole became a pool of water. Some craters were small lakes, deep enough to drown a man. It was a literally impassable barrier, bounded on both sides, a few hundred yards apart, by barbed wire barricades covered by machine guns. And day after day, month after month, Haig, advised by a general staff that almost never visited conditions at the front from their headquarters in the rear, continued to send men through this mud into the wire and the machine guns, dying 10,000 at a time in a morning. Airmen flew over that battlefield in various roles, reconnaissance, artillery spotting, sometimes dropping grenades. Almost inevitably, as they looked down at troops dying in the mud below them, or huddled against artillery in fetid trench lines that scarcely move from one month to the next, the spectacle impelled them to think, there has to be a better way of fighting war than this. For such airmen, and the designers and producers of large aircraft, the answer was plain. It was the airplane itself. Planes of longer range and heavier bomb load than were available before the Great War ended. Such aircraft would offer the possibility of moving over that barbed wire and even beyond the stalemated battle lines to attack the vulnerable civilian economy that supported the troops. This was the vision of so-called strategic bombing, overflying or bypassing battlefronts with long-range bombers to attack targets far in the rear of the engaged ground forces. One of the earliest champions of this concept was an Italian general named Giulio Duet, who was later briefly Mussolini's first commissioner for air, and a long-term associate of a manufacturer of bombing aircraft, Giovanni Caproni. Duet laid down a number of principles that were called, quite appropriately, doctrine, since they came to be held among a body of military airmen with the tenacity and fervor of a religious faith. They were beliefs that were a requirement and badge of membership in what might well be described as a cult of air power. One of these principles was that the characteristics of the bomber gave an overwhelming advantage to the side that struck first in massive force. There were controversies as to what should be struck first, but Duet's emphasis was on bombing cities for what he called the morale effect, paralyzing the other side's will, not simply its capability to carry on the war. Duet's recommendations clearly breach the principles of just war doctrine embodied in international law, specifically the unconditional prescription against any deliberate killing of non-combatants. Nevertheless, among airmen like Duet in Italy, Lord Trenchard in Britain, and General Billy Mitchell, the chief of American air operations in France, the idea of the strategic use of air power pointed to a better way of waging war. In the Continental Powers, whose armed forces were dominated by the army, this was not the answer to avoiding the battlefield deadlock that ground war seemed to have become. Nazi Germany, in its blitzkrieg attack on France, showed the effective use of tanks and close support aircraft together as combined arms of a ground commander. But the theory that offered itself to some airmen was that air power, if properly used, might win the war by itself, or at least prove a decisive element. What Duet envisioned, with the encouragement of Caproni, who sought to sell large aircraft to all the parties, including the United States, was a bomber that could carry a significant bomb load, a ton or more of explosives, deep into the enemy territory and drop it on their capital and other major cities. The main notion of Duet and others was that with a relatively small number of bombs measured in hundreds to thousands of tons, you could cause such panic as to totally disorganize the enemy's centers and cause enormous political pressure on the rulers to end a war. A somewhat larger tonnage, if necessary, would actually annihilate those cities. The airmen who proposed such a strategy, regarded by nearly everyone else as unconscionable barbarism, had a compelling desire to have an independent air force, to get out from under the operational control of the army. Airmen felt infantry and artillery staffs didn't understand the potentiality of air power. They didn't understand the machines, didn't have the vision to see what could be done with long-range heavy bombers. Furthermore, the kind of bombers that these men wanted to fly and thought would be effective were extremely expensive. This meant that only quite rich nations could afford such a bombing force, and even in those nations, it would be competing for resources against other military services, with their tanks, artillery, and battleships. So from early on, the airmen had an obsession that they must have a separate air force, which would have its own bureaucratic base to fight for its proper share of the budget. Secondly, to justify a separate service, they wanted higher levels of command and budget authority to share their own belief in the decisive, war-winning potential of their strategic mission, independent from the conduct of battlefield combat. This gave them a strong incentive to believe and fervently propagate as an article of faith a doctrine that had not ever been tested, and which had little evidence to support it. The belief that enough planes capable of carrying a heavy load of bombs over a long distance could effectively and quickly win a war. Duet's theories appealed to airmen in every country in the world, but in the end, only the political leadership in Britain and America endorsed the idea of building up a force for this purpose. The word strategic, as used here, was introduced to refer to an independent role for the Air Force beyond what were described as battlefield targets. The latter role was called tactical bombing, and it was used in close association with the Army. This new use of the word strategic is reflected in our reference to strategic nuclear weapons for long-range delivery, generally heavier warheads, versus tactical or battlefield nuclear weapons of shorter range and relatively lower yields. Both usages came out of this air power doctrine, the strategy of aiming at the economy or the civil society of the enemy. This strategy was conceived as being effective militarily in two distinct ways. Very early on, both Duet and Trenchard, the father of the Royal Air Force, emphasized the idea of breaking civilian morale and will to support the war, though Trenchard also urged destroying the productive capability of the enemy. In the U.S. Air Force, before and during World War II, a different form of the doctrine took hold, which was that you would aim quite precisely at industrial targets that were civilian but which had a direct bearing on warfighting capability, for example, aircraft factories. The Americans believed their Norden bombsight permitted them to bomb with extreme accuracy, which they called pickle barrel bombing, from the conceit that you could land a bomb in a pickle barrel. In fact, they would practice in their training to hit not just a particular industrial complex, but a particular corner of a particular building. They believed they could land these bombs on the average with what we would now call a circular error probability, CEP, a miss distance of less than 100 yards. That meant they expected that half the bombs aimed at a particular point would land within 100 yards of that point, half outside that circle. This was actually fairly far away for the relatively low-yield bombs of those days, dropped from planes at lower altitudes. A 500-pound bomb at a distance of 100 yards would not necessarily do any damage to what you were aiming at. But a CEP of 100 yards meant that if enough bombs were dropped, a fair number of them would get closer than that. They also drew on another premise of Douhet's doctrine, which was that there was really no defense against bombers sent in sufficient numbers. As the British Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin said in 1932, "The bomber will always get through." The Americans thought that the precision of the Norden bomb sight would permit them to bomb from extremely high altitudes, above the effective levels of enemy defenses. In any case, they believed only a small number of bombers had to get through to have a decisive effect on industry or civilian morale. Of course, civilians would be killed, even if they weren't the designated targets. Some bombs would miss the targeted factories, and civilians who worked in those factories would die. Though in industrial war, air power advocates would deny them non-combatant status. But any attack aimed directly at civilian targets, whether to impede the economy or for the sake of undermining morale, would blatantly violate earlier principles of warfare. However, the moral justification of any of this was clear in the minds of these strategists. Better to kill a few civilians and get the war over with quickly than to observe scrupulously and meticulously a distinction between civilians and military, and thereby doom both countries to a repetition of World War I. In other words, it was their ethical conviction that this was the most humane, indeed the only moral way to carry on a modern war. Fewer people would be killed overall on both sides from this approach. This justification was based on the assumption that the bombing would be effective quickly with relatively small numbers of bombs, and that belief depended on several other beliefs that British and American planners held. 1. That British and American bombers could sustain the loss rates from defenses flying in daylight. 2. That they could bomb accurately enough in daytime to destroy enemy bases and factories. 3. That they could find towns and industrial targets accurately at night, if necessary, and still destroy factories. 4. That for the Americans, those B-17s flying in mass formations above anti-aircraft fire had enough armament, they were called flying fortresses, to ward off enemy fighters and keep losses low in daytime, without needing long-range interceptors to defend them. 5. That while dodging defenses in poor weather over the European continent, American bombardiers could achieve the pickle-barrel accuracy they demonstrated in straight runs over the Arizona desert without cloud cover. 6. That with attainable accuracy, American bombers could destroy critical bottlenecks and vulnerabilities in German industrial networks that would cripple war production. 7. That through the use of high explosives and incendiaries, British bombers flying at night could dehouse a huge fraction of the German population, destroying German will to fight, and 8. That the morale of the German population, and later the Japanese, was far more fragile under bombing than that of the Chinese, Spanish, or British had proved to be. Each of these assumptions, every one of them, all articles of faith among strategic bombing enthusiasts, was decisively disproven by experience in the first years of World War II. But the bombing continued, and greatly increased. For the first couple of years of the war, the Americans didn't come into the European theater until 1943. The British were bombing as the major part of their war effort. In fact, after their troops were forced off the continent at Dunkirk in 1940, it was the only offensive effort they could take. And making that effort, effective or not, was prompted by strong political motivations. They had to counter the general conviction in the world that Hitler was bound to win the war, especially after his early successes in Russia in 1941. In 1940 and 1941, it was particularly important to the British to show their potential American allies that they were fully in the fight, that they were an ally worth supporting. Likewise, after mid-1941, to show the Soviets that the British were taking and inflicting losses in fighting Germans, even if not comparable to those on the Eastern Front. Bomber Command offered itself as the only force that could deliver either message. After the United States was attacked at the end of 1941, it was still important to show that aid to Britain was as important to America as its own competing rearmament. Lord Trenchard, who had managed to achieve independent status for the British Air Service in World War I, not achieved by the USAAF until it became USAF in 1947, agreed with Douette that strategic bombing should aim not only at enemy productive installations, but at the morale of the civilian population. The word he used for morale, incidentally, was moral effect, as in, the moral effect is to physical effect as 20-1. This makes a peculiar impression on an American reader, since the moral objective it refers to involves the deliberate killing of civilians. So the agreement that Britain made on September 2, 1939, the day after Roosevelt's appeal, that they would not bomb civilian populations, was potentially quite a restriction on what Bomber Command was really preparing itself to do in terms of producing heavy bombers, such as the four-engine Lancaster that came into operation in early 1942. Hitler had not bought into this doctrine of strategic bombing, nor had he ever prepared for it. Indeed, he had no four-engine bombers, the heavy bombers of the type that Britain and America had been designing since the 1930s. In Germany, France, Russia, and Italy, the predominant army officers and the political leadership looked at these doctrines and said, "Nonsense, civilians won't collapse that easily. It's too expensive, you won't get much effect. The way to use airplanes is in close support of troops and tanks." From the point of view of the British and American air forces, this thinking was simply service bias, hidebound, and anachronistic. But in retrospect, it was right. In terms of cost and effectiveness, the Air Force tenets were simply wrong. In any case, only Britain and America had really prepared themselves in the way of designing heavy bombers for long-range heavy bombardment. And this was not a response to Hitler's aggressions. It started well before Hitler came to power. Hitler, for his part, really didn't want to invite reciprocal attacks early on in the war, if ever. Nevertheless, in the first month of the war, his planes, short-range and medium-range bombers, attacked the heart of Warsaw, which his troops had surrounded. It was technically true that the legal prohibition over the last 200 years of deliberately harming civilians had a practical exception, which was that cities under siege that did not surrender, cities that defended themselves, could be bombarded by artillery as an example to others and to make them surrender. Hitler apparently conceived of this air attack as part of a siege operation, though this time carried on from the air rather than by artillery. Thus the Nazis defended it, perhaps sincerely, as not being in contradiction to their assurance to FDR at the start of the month. Nevertheless, for intimidating political effect to show his ruthlessness, the Germans publicized films of dive bomber attacks on the center of Warsaw and on fleeing refugees on roads. Hitler, or rather the German people, later paid heavily for this propaganda success. However, Hitler did not want to start strategic bombardment of cities outside the battle area. He understood the British were preparing for it. He understood that his cities were vulnerable, and he didn't want German civilian morale and support to be tested by that kind of bombardment. The next year he actually signed an order in the battle for France, and later prior to the Blitz, in the preparations for attacking Britain, that no attacks on cities should be made unless with his express permission. Indeed, for the first 8 months of the war, both sides felt it was worthwhile to avoid starting a process of reprisals on cities. Even after the attack on Warsaw, and throughout the spring of 1940, the British High Command was not ready to take the gloves off. That was the phrase the British used for the decision allowing Bomber Command to use its bombers the way Trenchard wanted, and the way his friend Winston Churchill, his superior as Secretary of State for Air and War in 1919 when Trenchard had been Chief of the Air Staff, wanted. Hitler had regarded his attack on Warsaw as a demonstration of the fate of defended cities. Likewise, when the Germans bombed the center of Rotterdam on May 14, 1940, that city was under siege. Holland was still refusing to surrender, though negotiations were underway. The German ground commander, General Rudolf Schmidt, called for a bombing strike. But while the bombers were on their way, Schmidt tried to call them off because the garrison, he had learned, was on the verge of surrender. It was too late. Half the bombers did not get the message. Though Schmidt put up red flares as a warning that they should go back, the pilots didn't understand, and they destroyed the city center of Rotterdam. This occasioned a rare apology by the German military to the Dutch people. The initial word from the Dutch press was that 30,000 people had died. In fact, it was just under 1,000. Nevertheless, the larger figure created an enormous sensation, and Britain announced that they would not be bound by the promise they had made to FDR, nor by the policy they had followed up to that point. The day after the bombing of Rotterdam, May 15th, the British cabinet sent bombers into Germany for the first time against strategic targets in densely populated areas. The gloves were off. I had long been following the phenomenon of strategic bombing, first horrified by the Nazi bombing of London, then following up when I had access to classified studies at the Air Force-sponsored RAND Corporation. One of the best accounts on the movement towards strategic bombing, which had a great influence on me when I read it at RAND, is The Road to Total War, Escalation in World War II, by Fred Salinger. The unclassified RAND report R-465PR is dated 1969, but I first read it as an internal document about 10 years before that. I had a number of talks about it with Fritz Salinger, as we knew him. He was looking for lessons from World War II that might suggest how nuclear escalation could develop and proceed in a conventional war that turned nuclear. He was particularly concerned with the possibility of keeping such a war limited and under control. One of his themes was how often escalation developed in terms of misunderstandings, misinterpretations, and failures of command and control, as with the bombing of Rotterdam just described. That had served as the trigger and justification for Winston Churchill, who had come into office only 4 days earlier, to unleash the RAF for bombing civilian areas in Germany, something he had long believed in doing. As he said to the Minister of Aircraft Production on July 8, 1940, "There is one thing that will bring Hitler back and bring him down, and that is an absolutely devastating, exterminating attack by very heavy bombers from this country upon the Nazi homeland. We must be able to overwhelm them by this means." Nevertheless, it was crucial in the minds of the British public and many officials that this new British policy was introduced in the context of reciprocity. Said Churchill, "This is the way to pay them back. It's legitimate for us to do so. And in fact, it's virtually obligatory for us to do so. If he's starting this form of warfare, it's necessary for us to do the same." On the day the German attack on France and the Low Countries commenced, planes bombed the German university town of Freiburg. The Nazis denounced this as a violation of the Allies' assurance they would not initiate bombings of undefended cities. The bombing was, in fact, a mistake by German Luftwaffe planes, which after a navigational error thought they had bombed a target in France. It took 40 years for the German commander in charge to acknowledge this mistake and false report in 1980. The propensity for such costly errors was further demonstrated on the night of August 24, 1940, when German bombers drifted off course during a planned attack on oil refineries on the Thames and ended up bombing houses in London. Hitler, at this point still trying to avoid reprisal, had in fact issued the strictest orders that no bomb should fall on London, while reserving that as a possibility for later on. Nevertheless, this initial attack prompted the first British attacks on Berlin the next day, August 25th, and then the day after that, followed by 6 attacks within the next 10 days. After the 5th of those, Hitler was saying, "We will pay back 100-fold if you continue this. If you do not stop this bombing, we will hit London." Churchill kept up the attacks, and 2 weeks after that first attack, on September 7th, the Blitz commenced. The first deliberate attacks on London. This was presented by Hitler as his response to British attacks on Berlin. The British attacks, in turn, were presented as a response to what was believed to be a deliberate German attack on London. In the beginning of the British strategic bombing, there was some debate between factions that believed in targeting civilian morale, and a more dominant part of the air staff